And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, I tried my best to talk to the powers that be, but last Tuesday at Target, my wife was attacked. Man was not wearing his mask. His wife was running around drinking a cup of coffee. My wife, who's been in the medical field for many, many years, suggested he put on his mask, and he just had a fit. I chased her to the car when I went to the pharmacy to get her something and was shaking his finger and just really showing his ass. She sent me a text, and by the time I arrived, he'd gotten gone. But I tried to talk to Target, their executive office. They didn't want to hear it. The local management, very sympathetic, but they didn't want to hear it. So if somebody gets attacked and injured at a Target store, be warned. Okay, today is February 16th, 47th day of the year, 318 days until the end of the year. On this day in history, in 1249, Andrew of Longjumeau was dispatched by Louis IX of France as ambassador to meet with the Khagan of the Mongol Empire. 1270, the Grand Duchy of Lithuania defeats the Livonian Order at the Battle of Carus. 1630, Dutch forces led by Hendrik Lonck capture Linda and what was to become part of Dutch Brazil. 1646, the Battle of Torrington in Devon. That's the last major battle of the First English Civil War. 1699, the first Leopoldine diploma was issued by the Holy Roman Emperor, recognizing the Greek Catholic clergy enjoyed the same privileges as Roman Catholic priests in the Principality of Transylvania. 1742, Spencer Compton, Earl of Wilmington, becomes British Prime Minister. 1796, Colombo in Ceylon, which is now Sri Lanka, falls to the British, completes her invasion of Ceylon. 1804, First Barbary War. Stephen Decatur leads a raid to burn the pilot Herald frigate USS Philadelphia, which had been captured by the pirates. 1,240-ton, 36-gun frigate. It was the second vessel in the U.S. Navy to be named after Philadelphia. Originally, she was named City of Philadelphia, built for the United States government by the citizens of Philadelphia, designed by Joshua Fox and built by Samuel Humphreys, Nathaniel Hutton, and John Delavue. Best remembered for her burning after being captured in Tripoli. The went to sea for duty in the West Indies to serve in a quasi-war with France. Lived in Guadeloupe Station in May of 1800 to leave the frigate Constellation. It captured five French iron vessels and recaptured six merchant ships that the French had captured. Well, it ran aground during the First Barbary War. The captain tried to refloat it. Wasn't able to do that. Jettisoned the cannons, the water, and other heavy articles, but that didn't do any good. So it was taken by the pirates. And Stephen Decatur, the son of the Philadelphia's first master, was given a task of destroying it. And, Britain's Viscount Nelson said what took place during this raid was the most bold, daring act of the age. However, it may or may not be true. 1862, Ulysses S. Grant captures Fort Donelson in Tennessee. 1866, Spencer Compton Cavendish, Marquis of Hartington, becomes the British Secretary of War. 1881, the Canadian Pacific Railway is incorporated by the Act of Parliament at Ottawa. 1899, Iceland's first football club is founded. Won't even begin to try to pronounce it. 1918, the Council of Lithuania unanimously adopts the Act of Independence, declaring Lithuania an independent state. On this date in 1923, the renowned Howard Carter unsealed the burial chamber of Pharaoh Tutankhamun. 1930, the Romanian Football Federation joins FIFA. 1934, the Austrian Civil War ends with the defeat of the Social Democrats and the Republikanischer Schutzbund. 1936, the Popular Front wins the 1936 Spanish general election. 1937, Wallace Carruthers gets a U.S. patent for nylon. 1940, Altmark incident. The German tanker Altmark is boarded by sailors from the British destroyer HMS Cossack. 299 British prisoners on board the German tanker are freed. 1942, in Athens, the Greek People's Liberation Army is established. 1943, in the early phases of the Third Battle of Kharkov, Red Army troops re-enter the city. 1945, American forces land on Corregidor Island in the Philippines. 1945, the Alaska Equal Rights Act of 1945, the first anti-discrimination law in the U.S. is signed into law. 1959, Fidel Castro becomes premier of Cuba after Fulgencio Batista, the dictator, was overthrown January 1st. 1960, U.S. Navy submarine USS Triton begins Operation Sandblast, sets sails to New London, Connecticut to begin the first submerged circumnavigation of the globe. 1961, Explorer 9 is launched. 1962, flooding in the coastal areas of West Germany kills 315 and destroys the homes of about 60,000 people. 1968, in Haleyville, Alabama, the first 911 emergency telephone system goes into service. 1978, the first computer bulletin board system is created in Chicago. 1983, the Ash Wednesday bushfires in Victoria and South Australia kill 75. On this date, 1985, Hezbollah is founded. 1986, the Soviet liner MS Mikhail Lermontov runs aground on the Marlborough Sounds in New Zealand. 1986, China Airlines Flight 2265 crashes into the Pacific near Pingu Airport in Taiwan. All 13 people on board are killed. 1991, Nicaraguan Contras leader Enrique Bermudez is assassinated in Managua. 1996, the Chicago-bound Amtrak train to Capital Limited collides with a Mark commuter train bound for Washington, D.C. 11 people die. 1998, China Airlines Flight 676 crashes into a road in a residential area near Chiang Kai-shek International Airport in Taiwan. All 196 on board are killed and 7 more people on the ground. 2005, the Kyoto Protocol comes into force following its ratification by Russia. For those who don't know what the Kyoto Protocol is, it's an international treaty that extends the 1992 UN Framework Convention on Climate Change that commits state parties to reduce greenhouse gas emissions based on the scientific consensus that global warming is occurring and it's extremely likely human-made CO2 emissions have predominantly caused it. What they're overlooking is all the damage caused by moose flatulence. I read quite a little write-up about the dangers of moose flatulence. In fact, I was in some store, and they had moose corks for sale. So if you got a moose near you that is adding to the gas problem, I suggest you get a moose cork and run it down. 2005, the National Hockey League cancels the entire 2004-2005 regular season and the playoffs. 2006, the last Mobile Army Surgical Hospital is decommissioned by the U.S. Army. MASH, don't you know, after the TV show. 2013, a bomb blast at a market in Hazara town, Quetta in Pakistan, kills more than 80 and injures 190 others. Well, a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances, Christian Feast Day, Abda of Edessa, Elias and Companions, Giuliarta of Nicodemia in the Catholic Church, Onesimus, Charles Todd Quintard in the Episcopal Church in the U.S., Day of the Shining Star, Kim Jong-il's birthday in North Korea, Restoration of Lithuania's statehood, which celebrates its independence from Russia and Germany in 1918, is celebrated in Lithuania, and Elizabeth Perotovich Day in Alaska. I'm not sure who that is. Oh, she's an American civil rights activist, president of the Alaska Native Sisterhood, member of the Tlingit Nation, works for equality on behalf of Alaska Natives. She died December 1st, 1958. I'm looking at a picture of her. Rather attractive. All right, let's see what else we've got. In 374, the ninth recorded perihelion passage of Halley's Comet. In the year 600, Pope Gregory the Great, he was the Pope, don't you know? He has to be great. Decree saying God bless you is the correct response to a sneeze. The theory was that a sneeze was caused by demons who got into your nose. And the sneeze is God's way of getting them out of your system, so God bless you was the proper response. In 1486, Maximilian I is elected king of the Romans at Frankfurt. 1512, battle at Valognio. French troops beat Venetian. In 1559, Pope Paul IV calls for deposition of sovereigns supporting heresy. In other words, if you support heresy, you lose your throne. So says God. 1641, the English King Charles I accepts Triennial Act requiring that Parliament meet for at least a 50-day session once every 3 years. Otherwise, they can party all they want to. 1659, the first known check was written. It was for £400. It's on display at Westminster Abbey. 1666, the Netherlands and Brandenburg sign a treaty. 1677, the Earl of Shaftesbury gets the shaft. He was arrested and confined in the Tower of London. 1741, Benjamin Franklin's General Magazine begins publishing. 1760, Native American hostages are killed in Fort Prince George in South Carolina. 1824, the Athenaeum Club is founded in London. 1838, Kentucky passes a law that permits women to attend school under certain conditions. 1838, the Weenen Massacre. Hundreds of Vert Trekkers along the Blaukrans River in Natal are killed by Zulu warriors. 1840, Charles Wilkes discovers the Shackleton Ice Shelf, one more time, in Antarctica. 1846, the Battle of Sobraon ends the First Sikh War in India. 1852, Studebaker Brothers Wagon Company, which is the precursor of the automobile manufacturer, is established. Excuse me. 1857, Gallaudet College, the National Deaf Mute College, formed in Washington, D.C. 1861, Abraham Lincoln stops his train at Westfield on his way to Washington to thank an 11-year-old by the name of Grace Bedell in person for her advice that he grow a beard to gain more votes. 1864, the Battle of Mobile, Alabama, won by the Union Army. 1868, the Benevolent Protective Order of Elks forms in New York. 1883, the Ladies' Home Journal begins publishing. 1887, the first newspaper convention is held in Rochester, New York. 1894, British troops occupy Loren on the Gold Coast in Africa. 1900, the first Chinese daily newspaper in the U.S. is published, Chung Sai Yat Po in San Francisco. 1909, the first subway car that had side doors is put into service in New York City. 1909, Serbia mobilizes against Austria-Hungary. 1913, President Taft agrees not to intervene in the revolution in Mexico. 1914, the first airplane flight from L.A. to San Francisco. 1916, Russian troops conquered the Ottoman Empire city of Erzurum during World War I. 1916, the German ambassador in Washington announces Germany will pay an indemnity for the American lives lost on the Lusitania when it was torpedoed and sunk by U-boat. 1917, the first synagogue in 425 years opens in Madrid. 1923, the Allies accept Latvia's occupation of Memel territory. 1929, KIDAM in Idaho Falls, Indiana. Excuse me, Idaho. Begins radio transmission. 1929, there was a murder mystery that's never been solved. It was considered a murder-suicide. Ned Doheny Jr., son of oil magnate Edward Doheny, dies along with Secretary Hugh Plunkett at the Greystone Mansion in Beverly Hills. It was believed to be a murder-suicide. Okay. In 1936, the Spanish Frente Popular, the People's Front, wins elections. 1942, German submarines attack the Aruba oil refinery. 1942, in the Bangka Island Massacre, Japanese soldiers machine gun 22 Austrian Army nurses and 60, excuse me, Australian Army nurses and 60 Australian and British soldiers and crew members from two sunken ships. Only one nurse and two soldiers survived the massacre. 1943, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill contracts pneumonia. 1943, a sign on a Munich facade said, "Out with Hitler, long live freedom." It was done by the White Rose student group, who were caught February 18th and beheaded February 22nd. Hitler didn't have much of a sense of humor. 1943, on this date, USSR reconquers Kharkov. 1945, a little late, Venezuela declares war on Nazi Germany. 1946, the first commercially designed helicopter is tested in Bridgeport, Connecticut. 1948, on this date, the first newsreel telecast, 20th Century Fox's Movie Tell News, shown on NBC. 1950, the longest-running primetime game show, What's My Line, begins broadcast on CBS. Okay. In 1963, the first round trip swim of the Strait of Messina in Italy, done by Mary Revel of the U.S. In 1963, philosopher Hannah Arendt's controversial account of the trial of Nazi war criminal Adolf Eichmann is published in the New Yorker. He was tried in 1961 in Jerusalem, but they kept a lid on it until 63. And all that having been said, I think we finished our first part of the show, which is our history segment. We've been talking about strange creatures like werewolves and big black cats. In the summer of 2007, a falconer by the name of Martin Whitley, he lived in the English county of Devon. He took a number of photos of a very curious black-colored dog-like animal in the wilds of Dartmoor. That's the same area where Sir Arthur Conan Doyle set his classic Sherlock Holmes novel, The Hounds of the Baskervilles. According to Whitley, it was June 9th, 2007 when all this took place. According to him, he was flying a hawk on Dartmoor with some American clients. Apparently, falconing is still quite popular. But he was flying a hawk on Dartmoor with some American clients when one of them pointed out this creature. He's walking along a path about 200 yards away from him. He's black and gray and comparable in size to a miniature pony. He had very thick shoulders, he said. A long, thick tail with a blunt end and small, round ears. It moved like a feline, but it was also described by others as bear-like. Now, there was a party climbing on the tor opposite where the falconers were. And they were making quite a bit of noise, but the creature ignored them completely. According to Merrill Lee Harper, a noted authority on mystery animals in the UK, she studied the photos of the creature and said, Martin's American clients took a series of photos of this creature, and they show the Dartmoor landscape, the school party on the tor, and in the middle distance, an animal which seems to change shape in each frame, from cat to bear to pony to boar to various breeds of dog. Indeed, members of the BC1B, the Big Cats in Britain Research Group, the British version of the Westminster Kennel Club show, in attempting to give the creature a rational explanation, while the proximity of Hound Tor suggested to some a possible kinship to Devon's spectral wished hounds. Now, Whitley may not have known what the creature was, but he was certain it wasn't just a dog. As he said when questioned, he said, I've worked with dogs all my life, and it's definitely not canine. I've also seen a collie-sized black cat in the area about 10 years ago, and this wasn't that. This was bigger. Now, John Downs of the Monster Hunting Center for Fortean Zoology took a more skeptical approach. Suspected the creature was indeed a large dog, and the seeming ability of the creature to shapeshift resulted from nothing stranger than the technical limitations of the camera that was used to capture the pictures. The dog angle was also championed by the UK's Daily Mail newspaper. Its staff talked to a local woman named Lucinda Reed, who believed that what had been photographed was actually her pet Newfoundland dog, Troy. And certainly Troy, like all Newfoundlands, was a formidable and sizable creature. He weighed just under 170 pounds. According to what Reed told the Daily Mail, I was in stitches when I read that somebody thought Troy was the beast of Dartmoor. I spotted it was him right away. You can tell by the shape and the way he's walking. We go up to that spot on Dartmoor all the time. It's only 10 minutes from our house, and Troy loves to run about there. Now, a lot of people don't know what he is because he's so big. He frightens the life out of everybody because of his size and doesn't look like a dog from a distance. And he sometimes disappears off around the rocks on his own. That's when he must have been photographed. Now, Troy is certainly nothing to be afraid of, she said. He's a big softy. So if anybody sees him on the moor, there's no need to panic. He's not a monster. Now, of course, not everybody was quite so sure Troy was the cause of this sensational story. Aside from the fact that the animal in the photo does appear to change shape, there's the matter of the location where the picture was taken. It's extremely close to a place known locally as Bowerman's Nose. It's a granite outcrop on the north slopes of Haney Down and only about a mile from a place called Hound Tor. And there's a very weird legend attached to the Tor, and that's how it got its name. According to the ancient folklore, about 1,000 years ago, lived on the wilds of Dartmoor a man named Bowerman. Skilled hunter, someone who knew the old mysterious landscape very well. One particular day while out hunting, his pack of hunting dogs came upon something else, a secret coven of witches, hidden deep within a series of previously unknown caves out on the moorland. Well, Bowerman's dogs raced around the caves in chaotic fashion, knocking over a huge cauldron that was a specific part of an ancient ritual the witches were about to perform. Now, Bowerman managed to get control of his dogs and got out of there quickly. The witches, though, were determined to have their revenge. One of these crone-like coven shapes shifted into a hare and coldly lured Bowerman and his dogs into marshy ground that swallowed up one and all. But the witches weren't done with Bowerman and his pack. No, not by a long shot. They hauled the dead bodies out of the marsh and turned them to stone. According to the old legend, a line of rocks at the peak of Hound's Tor is comprised of the dogs turned to stone, while an outcrop called Bowerman's Nose is all that remains of the dog's master. But there's still more to the story. That very same area of landscape is the home to what's become known as the Whist Hounds, briefly referred to earlier by Merrily Harper. Like the monster dog in Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Hound of the Baskervilles, which actually was based on the old legends, the Whist Hounds are huge, black, deadly dogs of a paranormal kind that sported blazing red eyes. They preyed upon the bodies and souls of the unfortunate people that dared to intrude upon their territory. And on top of that, as if that wasn't enough, not at all far away is Buckfastly, which in the 17th century is the home of Squire Richard Cable, the inspiration for evil Sir Hugo Baskerville in Conan Doyle's much-loved novel. Local lore tells of how on the night Cable died, a vicious pack of savage black hounds was seen racing across the moonlit moor. Taking into consideration the sheer number of strange and centuries-old stories about supernatural hounds in this very same area where Martin Whitley's friends photographed something, it's no wonder the idea it was Troy, the Newfoundland, is met with much skepticism by monster hunters. Now, while this matter has never been resolved to anybody's satisfaction, it did provide Troy with brief nationwide fame. He got his picture in the paper. Well, from England, let's go to Orange, Texas. Now, Solomon was interviewed back in 2003 when he was in his mid-80s. And he discussed the startling encounter he had with a shape-shifting creature no fewer than 70 years before that, when he was just a teenager. Location was a dense area of woodland in Orange, Texas. It was a normal Sunday morning when he and his friends were exploring the woods and having a good time. After a couple of hours of scouting around, they found a place to sit and began to eat into the lunch they'd brought with them. Now, all was going just fine, and one of the group experienced that eerie sensation we all get from time to time. That feeling that you're being watched. And watched closely. Well, before long, the rest of the group had that same feeling. Almost in unison, they looked across the stream that was in front of them, only to see nothing less than a large wolf-like head peering directly at them, stuck out of the dense foliage. When the creature realized it had been seen, it suddenly broke out of the undergrowth and paced along the water's edge in a disturbingly prowling fashion. all four boys wondered if they were being sized up for lunch, so to speak. As the creature made its presence fully known, the friends were shocked to see that although it resembled a wolf, the monster thing was around 10 feet in length and had a huge muscular body, far beyond that of any normal wolf. On several occasions, the monster stopped and stared at the boys, growling at them in a dark and deep, low and guttural fashion. Not surprisingly, the four boys were actually too frightened to move. And then suddenly, something odd happened. That massive creature sat down and started to shake. Even more amazingly, it was suddenly surrounded by an eerie green fog, at which point the creature changed its stance. Its hind legs noticeably morphed to the point it was able to rear up onto those same hind legs and loom over the now nearly hysterical boys at a height of about 10 feet. As for its front limbs, they took on a distinctly human-looking form, although covered with black hair. For a few moments, the man-beast snapped and snarled at the group, still on the other side of the stream. Then it suddenly turned and vanished into the woods and disappeared. They didn't see it again. It was a one and only paranormal experience in Solomon's life, and frankly, according to Solomon, he was quite happy to keep it that way. Well, you know, in addition to the ABCs that we talked about in England, there's also the phantom black dogs. Now, in his book, Explore Phantom Black Dogs, the author and researcher, Bob Trubshaw, discussed in some detail that the folklore of phantom black dogs is known throughout the British Isles. From the black shuck of East Anglia to the mothy doog of the Isle of Man, there are tales of huge spectral hounds darker than the night sky with eyes glowing red as burning coals. And while there are a number of intriguing theories to explain the presence and nature of these spectral-like creatures, certainly the most ominous of all is that they represent some form of precursor to or instigator of doom, tragedy, and death. One of the most infamous of all black dog encounters in the British Isles occurred at St. Mary's Church in Bungay in Suffolk, in England. It took place on Sunday, August 4, 1577. An immense, veritable spectral hound from hell materialized inside the church during a powerful thunderstorm and mercilessly tore into the terrified congregation with its huge fangs and razor-sharp claws. In fact, so powerful was the storm that it reportedly killed two men in the belfry as the church tower got an enormous lightning bolt that tore through it and shook the building to its foundations. According to an old local verse, all down the church in midst of fire, the hellish monster flew, and passing onward to the choir, he many people slew. And then as suddenly as it appeared, this creature bounded out of St. Mary's and was reported shortly thereafter at Blythburg Church is about 12 miles away. There it allegedly killed and mauled even more people with its immense and bone-crushing jaws, and where it said the scorch marks of the beast's claws can still be seen to this day, infamously imprinted on the ancient door of the church. And even more intriguing is the fact that Bungay's legend of a satanic black hound parallels that of yet another local legend, that of the Black Shuck, giant spectral dog that haunts the Norfolk and Suffolk coast. Such is the popularity of the Bungay legend that it's resulted in an image of the beast being incorporated into the town's coat of arms. And the Black Dogs is the name of the Bungay Town Football Club. Soccer, don't you know? The stark, disturbing, memorable image of that infamous devil dog or the phantom hound as described earlier undoubtedly conjures up is that of a definitively sinister beast that stealthily prowls the towns and villages of ancient England by nothing more than the silvery moonlight or to the accompanying background of a violent crashing thunderstorm. But it's a little known fact outside of a dedicated students of the phenomena that sightings of these creatures have also taken place in modern times, in both the 20th and 21st centuries. Now, in discussing these more modern occurrences, there's the story of the Bradley family of the city of Leeds, who had the very deep misfortune to encounter one of these now familiar hounds of hell in the early 2009, at no less a site than the English city of Lichfield's famous and historic cathedral, which has the distinction of being the only English cathedral to be adorned by three spires. According to the Bradleys, they were walking around the outside of the cathedral one pleasant Sunday morning. They were startled by the sight of a large black dog racing along at high speed adjacent to the side of the cathedral. They said they put forth the jaw-dropping fact that the dog was practically the size of a donkey, which ensured that their attention was caught in hell. But that attention was rapidly replaced by overwhelming fear when the dog allegedly charged the wall of the cathedral and vanished right into the brickwork as it did so. Maybe understandably, the Bradleys chose not to report the mysterious encounter to the cathedral officials or to the local police. And then there's the account of Marjorie Sanders. Although her account can be considered a new one in a sense, it only became evident in August of 2009. It actually occurred back in the closing stages of the Second World War when the witness was a girl of 10 or 11. At that time, Sanders was living in a small village not too far from England's Tamworth Castle, which overlooks the River Tame, which has stood there since it was built by the Normans in the 11th century. Although it is built on the ruins of an earlier Anglo-Saxon castle, which was constructed by the forces of Ethelfreda, the Mercian queen, and the eldest daughter, King Alfred the Great of Wessex. According to Sanders, it was probably in the early 1945. Her grandfather had seen a hellhound parading around the outside of the castle that scared him half to death. And to make it even worse, it then vanished right in front of him. For reasons that Sanders can't remember or comprehend, her grandfather always after that memorably referred to the animal in question as the furnace dog. Whether or not this was an indication that the spectral dog had the seemingly ubiquitous fiery red eyes that so many witnesses have reported, it would seem, in all logic, that would be the explanation for calling it the furnace dog. And then we got a brief but thought-provoking account of Gerald Clark, a Glasgow baker whose father claimed to have briefly seen a large, black-colored phantom hound with bright electric blue-colored eyes on the grounds of a military base in central England. It was a Royal Air Force Stafford in the late 1950s, and he was a member of that unit on patrol one winter's evening. As was the case with so many other witnesses of such disturbing entities, the elder Clark quickly confided to his son that the creature just vanished. One minute it was there, the next minute it was gone. So in view of all that, I guess these areas need to have signs posted, beware of the dog. Well, up until the end of season 4 of The Walking Dead, we were familiar with seeing our struggling bunch of heroes hunkered down in a fortified Georgian prison, doing battle with both the dead and their arch-villain, the one-eyed governor. But the resurrection of the dead, people feeding on people, as it were, and the prison also have a place in the real world. Now, this story, though, revolves around monsters rather than the zombies created in this work of fiction. In the latter part of the 16th century, London, England's Newgate Prison was the site of a horrific series of deaths that would have made even the average walker proud in the extreme, if such creature does possess significant numbers of brains to be proud. Due to a pronounced lack of regular food, on more than a few occasions, the prisoners targeted the weakest members of the pack and turned on them for their sustenance. Very much a case of having to eat the living to avoid becoming one of the dead. In other words, we're talking about cannibals in the cell block. One of those savagely killed and partially eaten by the prisoners was an unnamed man who did exactly what the bit and equally semi-devoured of the prison of the Walking Dead did on so many occasions. He rose again. Not as a voracious devotee of raw human flesh, but as a ghastly, ghostly black dog with a pair of blazing red eyes. Now, the actions of this undead manhound were not at all unlike those of its television-based equivalents. The creature violently slaughtered all those who had taken its human life by savagely biting down on their necks with its immense powerful jaws. Death swiftly followed for the guilty parties. In their particular cases, though, there was no reanimation. When the deed was done, the man in the spectral dog form vanished, never to be seen again. And then there's the very similar and very weird tale of a pair of brothers, William and David Souter. The dark saga all began one night in December 1728 when William, a Scottish farmer, was hard at work in his fields and heard an unearthly shriek that was accompanied by the brief glimpse of a large, dark-colored dog, far bigger than any normal hound, and one possessed of a pair of glowing red eyes, similar in description to the beast from Newgate Prison. On several more occasions, during both 1729 and 1730, the dog came back, always seemingly intent on plaguing the Souter family. But it was in late November 1730 that the affair ultimately reached its paranormal pinnacle. Once again, the dog manifested before the farmer, but this time, incredibly, it was heard to speak in mumbling tones and direct a waiver to make his way to a specific nearby piece of ground within the next 30 minutes. Well, not knowing what else to do, he did as he was instructed, and there waiting for him was the spectral hound of hell. Well, terrified William demanded to know what was going on, and the creature answered he was nothing other than David Souter, William's brother, and he'd killed a man at that very spot 35 years before. Well, as David had directed his own savage dog to kill the man, David himself, as punishment, had been returned to our plane of existence in the form of a gigantic dog. And the dog man instructed William to seek out the buried bones of the murdered victim and place them within consecrated ground, which William hurried to do, and he put them in the confines of the old Blair churchyard. Well, once that was done, the ghostly black dog, the spirit of David Souter, in animal form, vanished. Its work done, it was never seen again. Well, we talked earlier about the Werewolf of Bedburg. In 1590, George Bors wrote a fascinating report on one of the most notorious cases of lycanthropy on record. Told the story of a deranged homicidal man named Peter Stube, who went on murdering killing sprees while, according to his claim, in the form of a terrifying werewolf. According to what Bors said, in the towns of Zapartan and Bedburg, near Collin in High Germany, was continually brought up and nourished one Stube, Peter. Now, there are several variations of spelling on this particular name, but from his youth, he was greatly inclined to evil and the practicing of wicked arts, even from 12 years of age until he reached 20, and so afterwards till his dying day. Inasmuch at surfeiting in the damnable desire of magic, necromancy, and sorcery, acquainting himself with many infernal spirits and fiends, insomuch that forgetting the god that made him, and that savior that has shed his blood for man's redemption, in the end, careless of salvation, gave both soul and body to the devil forever, and for small carnal pleasures in his life, that he might be famous and spoken of on earth, though he lost his chance to go to heaven. Bors went on to say the devil himself had pledged to provide Stube whatever his heart desired during his mortal life. With that promise, this vile wretch neither desired riches nor promotion, nor was his fancy satisfied with any external hour of pleasure. But he had a tyrannous heart and a most cruel, bloody mind, requested that at his pleasure he might work his malice on men, women, and children, in the shape of some beast, whereby he might live without dread or danger of life, and unknown to be the executor of any bloody enterprise that he might commit. Well, the devil, according to Bors, perceived Stube to be somebody who was a fit instrument to perform mischief as a wicked friend pleased with the desire of wrong and destruction. The horned one gave Stube a girdle, which, upon being put around his waist, mutated him into the likeness of a greedy, devouring wolf, strong and mighty, with eyes great and large, which in the night sparkled like unto brands of fire, and a mouth filled with sharp, cruel teeth, a huge body, and mighty paws. And no sooner should he put off the girdle, but he should appear in his former shape, according to the proportion of a man, as if he had never been changed. Well, Zen, having been given by the devil, no less, the ability to transform himself from man to monster and back again, he went on to commit his gruesome acts. Stu proceeded to the execution of sundry most heinous and vile murders, for if any person displeased him, he would have a thirst for revenge. He wouldn't rest until they got it. And no sooner should they or any of theirs walk abroad in the fields or about the city, but in the shape of a wolf, he'd presently encounter them, and never rest till he'd pluck out their throats and torn their joints asunder. And after he'd gotten a taste, he took such pleasure and delight in shedding of blood that he'd night and day walk the fields and work extreme cruelties. Well, Boris went into a great deal of detail regarding exactly how Stu would go about his deadly infernal business. At sundry times, he would go through the streets of Collin, Bedbur, and Sepperot in comely habit and very civilly, as one well known to all the inhabitants, and sometimes was he saluted of those whose friends and children he had butchered, though nothing suspected for the same. And actually, he was very highly thought of in the business world. Well, Stube in werewolf form had more than just murder in mind when it came to the women in the area. Often it came to pass that as he walked abroad in the fields, if he chanced to spy a company of maidens playing together and milking their kin, in his wolfish shape, he'd run among them, and while the rest escaped by flight, he'd make sure he grabbed one, and after he satisfied his lust, he would kill her. Besides, if he had liked or known any of them, whoever that might be, he would pursue, whether she was in front of him or behind, and take her from the rest, for such was his swiftness of foot that while he continued a wolf, he could outrun the swiftest greyhound in the country. And so much he had practiced his wickedness that the whole province was feared by the cruelty of this bloody devouring wolf. Eventually, though, his abominable reign was brought to a close. He was apprehended and put in the rack in the town of Bedbur, but fearing torture, he voluntarily confessed to everything he'd done. He also confessed how by sorcery he procured of the devil a girdle, which being put on allowed him to become a wolf. Well, when the magistrates heard it, they sent to the valley to get where he had hidden it, but at their coming found nothing at all. There were those that decided the devil probably came and took it back. Well, having spilled his guts as a result of fearing the torture, he had a lot to say. As Boris duly noted in his extensive study of Stube and his rampaging. And then they found out, as he was confessing, that his daughter, Belle Stube, and his gossip, Karen Trumpen, were both accessory to diverse murders committed, who for the same as also for their lewd wife otherwise committed was arraigned and Peter Stube condemned, and they were condemned as well. Peter Stube, as principal malefactor, was judged first to have his body laid on a wheel and red hot burning pinchers in 10 places to have the flesh pulled off the bone, and his daughter and the gossip were judged to be burned quick to ashes at the same time as Stube was killed. And so it was that Peter Stube's reign of lycanthropic terror was finally over. Now, few people who have read Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes novel, The Hound of the Baskervilles, forget the immortal words uttered by Dr. James Mortimer to the world's most famous fictional detective. Mr. Holmes, there were the footprints of a gigantic hound. May come as a surprise to some to learn that Conan Doyle's novel is actually based upon real legends of a giant devilish hound that was said to haunt Britain's village and countryside. Britain has a long, rich, and varied history of encounters with what have generally become known as phantom black dogs. Usually much larger than normal dogs, they're said to possess a pair of large, glowing eyes, Very often they're red in color. They frequent graveyards, old roadways, crossroads, and bridges, and almost unanimously associated with the realm of the dead. In some cases, these creatures appear to be demonstrably evil. In other reports, evidence exhibit of a helpful, maybe even concerned nature. Whatever the creatures are, they're not just your average flesh and blood animal. In fact, they might just be your worst nightmare. While the image of the phantom black dog is most associated with the British Isles and mainland Europe, the beast has been seen in many other locations as well, including Latin America. Leading researcher in this field is Simon Birchall, author of Phantom Black Dogs in Latin America. At 38 pages, his work is obviously very much a booklet rather than a full-length book, but that doesn't detract from the most important thing of all. His pages are packed with case after case, each offering the reader little-known and seldom-seen information on a definitive Latin American cousin to Britain's more famous counterpart. Notably, Birchall's publication details a truly startling wealth of similarities between these creatures, seen centuries ago in England and those reported throughout Latin America in the last 100 years, namely the diabolical glowing eyes, the association with the phantom hound as with life after death, how seeing the beast may be the precursor to doom and tragedy, its occasional helpful and guiding qualities, and the fact that the animal is usually witnessed in the vicinity of bridges, crossroads, and cemeteries. And let us not forget the fact it can shapeshift. He also reveals how the legends of the phantom black dog of some Latin American nations, such as Guatemala, has been exploited by those with draconian and outdated morals. For example, there are widespread tales of people who enjoy having a drink of, or several, incurring the dire wrath of the phantom black dog, which, according to Birchall, was certainly popularized by the Catholic Church that used the legend and others as moralizing tales. Then we have winged hounds, whose appearance and activity smack strongly of the modern-day chupacabras of Puerto Rico. He discusses these at length as a copious amount of data that make a link with tales of truly dark and satanic nature. Birchall also reveals intriguing data suggesting at least some tales of the black dog might be based on cultural memories and stories of a very real, large, ferocious hounds brought to the New World by the conquistadors. They were savage, ferocious dogs trained to kill and tear apart the Indians. That said, though, it's clear that the overwhelming majority of reports of the phantom black dog in Latin America parallel those of Britain to a truly striking, eerie, and extraordinary degree, in the sense that they appear to be something other than flesh and blood creatures. According to Bushell, although the black dog may appear at first glance to be a British or a North European phenomenon, it exists in essentially the same form across the entire length and breadth of the Americas. Much has been written about the presumed Germanic, Celtic, or Indo-European origin of the legend, but such an origin wouldn't explain how a Highland Maya girl can meet a shape-shifting black dog at a Guatemalan crossroad. So it would seem that the black dog, much like the poltergeist and other spirits of that nature, is actually a global phenomenon. And then we go to Texas again to talk about the chupacabra. Now, the Texas chupacabra is admittedly a very strange-looking hairless beast that have predominantly been reported within woods and fields in and around Austin and San Antonio, and now being seen with increasing frequency in the vicinity of the city of Dallas. One of the questions that keeps on coming up during these discussions of these creatures is how and under what particular circumstances did these mysterious beasts manage to get from the island of Puerto Rico? Well, the chupacabra reports began surfacing in the mid-1990s to the heart of the Lone Star State. Well, according to the best information, they didn't. While Puerto Rico's most infamous monster may well share its name with that which haunts the woods, ranches, and wilds of Texas, that's pretty much where the connection seems to end. Notably, there's nothing but outright disappointment in a response of that nature. But to confirm its truth, we need to take a look at what's really afoot and how the creatures of Texas have become entwined with those of Puerto Rico.
Now, there's been a number of expeditions made to Puerto Rico in search of the island's blood-sucking beast, and there's no doubt that they do exist. Been numerous ranchers and veterinarians and even civil defense employees and members of the public who've either seen the creatures or had been witness to their blood-sucking activities. In most cases, the chupacabras of Puerto Rico are described as bipedal creatures with large eyes, vicious claws, and teeth, hairless monkey-like bodies, and rows of spikes running down the backs of their heads and necks. They've been described as being punk-like, mohawk-style in nature, and even occasionally sporting membranous, bat-like wings. As for their mode of attack, most of the interviewees state the chupacabra killed their prey by a bite to the neck and then proceeded to drink the blood. But in Texas, we see something very different at work. In each and every case on record, the Texas chupacabra are most certainly not described as being bipedal in nature. Rather, they walk on four legs. There are no wings reported, no huge eyes, and certainly no spikes running down their heads. But that doesn't mean there's not high strangeness afoot. Yet, clearly it is. In most cases where we've been fortunate to secure the body of a Texas chupacabra, either after it's been shot or hit by a vehicle, the DNA analysis has proven with almost 100% certainty that these creatures actually have canine origins. Yeah, they do look weird, no question about it, but they are definitely from the dog family. But the story doesn't end there, though. Canine or not, they're certainly not normal. The lack of hair has led many commentators to suggest the animals are afflicted by mange, which could well be true. But not only are we now seeing pups with the adult features, but young and old alike seem to be adapting quite well to living without hair. There's none of the usual intense itching and scratching to the point of bleeding that's the typical of animals affected by mange. And a lack of hair doesn't appear to have any bearing on their ability to roam quite happily and comfortably in the pulverizing summer heat of Texas. And someone who shaves his head to the bone daily can say with certainty that Texas sun can certainly do some damage to the skin without adequate protection. In addition, in some cases, the front legs of the animals appear to be much shorter than we would consider normal, which does give them a weird hopping kangaroo-style gait. Others are reported to have elongated upper jaws, many have cataracts, and they appear in a highly aggressive nature around people, which is quite unlike normal wild canines that usually steer clear of people. And then there's their mode of attack, which a number of ranchers have said involves bites to the neck of farm animals and a sizable amount of blood drained from the bodies. And it's this later point, and arguably this latter point alone, which has led many people to believe that the Puerto Rico chupacabra and the Texas chupacabras are one and the same. But clearly they're not. The term chupacabra is a great marketing tool, though. It provokes intrigue and terror, and is a journalist's dream come true. And the whole thing has now gone viral within the media, on the net, and in monster hunting circles. So in other words, we got two distinctly different phenomena and evidence. One is born out of sightings of and encounters with truly unknown creatures on the island of Puerto Rico. And the other is focused on the weird-looking things in Texas that may have some extraordinary changes going on at a genetic level. Beyond that, all we can say for certain that real chupacabra is just like Vegas. What happens in Puerto Rico continues to stay in Puerto Rico, even though there are those that believe it's come to Texas. Well, we've come to the end of another show. We'll be back tomorrow night when, once again, we'll be talking about strange creatures. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.